set list in association with 7Digital.
This week, Lady A sue Lady A over who is the real Lady A. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when you, Chris Cook, were gearing up for the launch of your new book.
Yes, I am. That's a very good point. The third edition of Dissecting the Digital Dollar is out this week. As you're listening to this podcast, so we are publishing the third edition. If any of you listen to Alex Branson's podcast, where he interviews lots of very interesting people from all over the music industry, and me, earlier this year, I did an edition of his podcast, and a lot of that was talking about the fact that we have a new edition of the Digital Dollar book coming out. So this is based on the Dissecting Digital Dollar work that we and CMU have been doing with the Music Managers Forum here in the UK for 5 flipping years now. Can you believe we've been doing this for 5 years?
No, yes.
Well, we have, so you have to.
I just tore it up the last 5 years in my mind, and it would make sense that it's been 5 years.
Well, I'm glad I've got your belief. So 5 years we have been dissecting, analysing, debating how the streaming music business works. So originally it was a report that the MMF put out, and then there was a second report that followed because the first report raised lots of questions that needed to be debated. So MMF did the debating, and then the second report summarised that. Then, a couple of years ago, we merged those two reports together and updated them. We threw in some extra Digital Dollar guides, and that was the Dissecting Digital Dollar second edition, which was the first time it came out as a proper book. And now what we've done is we've taken that and we've updated it because, of course, various things have happened in the last couple of years, not least the European Copyright Directive, the Music Modernisation Act, Brexit, the increased debate around user-centric royalty distribution, partly because of what Deezer's been doing in that space. The rise of the TikToks and Instagrams of this world is becoming another important revenue stream. So lots of things have changed. So we have basically updated the book for 2020. And there are now 4 guides at the back, the various Digital Dollar guides that MMF has put out with us here at CMU. So as well as the Deals Guide and Transparency Guide, there's now also the Fan Data Guide and the Song Royalties Guide. All in one, now quite thick book. It's quite heavy now. It's getting...
Yes, I've got my copy.
It's getting quite weighty. So it's officially, even though he's got a copy, he's not really meant to have a copy, because officially we are publishing the third edition on this coming Thursday, the 16th of July. We're doing an event, so MMF is hosting a little event, an online event, obviously, given the way the world still is. So if you go to cmuinsights.com/digitaldollar, there's a link to where you can get tickets. It's free for that MMF event where we're going to be launching the Digital Dollar book. I will do a very quick summary of the updates, and then we've got some incredibly interesting people from across the industry talking about the issues and how things have changed and what might be the issues in the next 5 years. That is all going to be happening. So assuming you're getting this podcast on time, then you can sign up for tickets to that. It's at 5 o'clock this coming Thursday. Also, if you go to cmuinsights.com/digitaldollar, as of Thursday, there'll be the link to where you can order your copy of Dissecting Digital Dollar, the third edition. So obviously, that has been by far the most important thing that's been happening this week as we prepare for the launch next week, which will be the most important thing to happen next week, I am sure. So is this all we're going to talk about on this week's set list? Because it is the most important thing.
No, I think we've got some other stuff we need to chat through. Any of the book isn't even out yet, although, yeah, I do have my copy, and I've put it next to the previous copy, which one day I might read. And then...
Yeah, you got to read the second edition before you read the third edition. That you won't get the third edition. Anyway, all right then. Yes, this is not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, this week we are going to be discussing the UK government's latest concessions to the live music industry as the COVID-19 pandemic continues, but lockdown begins to lift. But first, the band formerly known as Lady Antebellum, Lady A, have sued another artist called Lady A over the use of that name. This despite the fact that the other artist has been using that name for longer than they've even been a band. The legal action comes after negotiations to allow both acts to exist with the same name collapsed, with the band pointing out that it is they, not her, who own the trademark in the name.
Yes, so we discussed the band formerly known as Lady Antebellum changing their name in a recent edition of Setlist. That happened, of course, in the wake of the most recent round of Black Lives Matter protests in the US and elsewhere in the world. The reason they made the change is because the word antebellum refers to a period in American history when the southern states of America went through a period of rapid economic growth, in no small part because of the institution of slavery at that time. And so therefore it has a connection with that period in American history and with the institution of slavery. And when they announced that they were going to officially change their name, the band basically said, "We never chose that word as a celebration of this period in American history. It was because they'd had an early photo shoot in a house that was sort of an antebellum design. So that's why they picked that word." But they did admit that with the benefit of hindsight, because you always have a lot of benefit when you employ hindsight, that they were both regretful and embarrassed by the name of their band, by their use of the antebellum word. And so, yeah, the official announcement a few weeks ago was, "We will no longer be known as Lady Antebellum. From this point onwards, we are going to be known by the name Lady A," which they insisted at the time wasn't actually as radical a change as you might think, because if you're a fan of the band, you will know that actually they've used Lady A as an alternative name pretty much since they formed back in 2006, and lots of fans and quite a lot of journalists, when they were talking about the band, tended to say Lady A rather than Lady Antebellum. So that was why they were deciding that they were going to get rid of the antebellum word, and from this point onwards, they would simply be known as Lady A.
Yes, and the fact that that name had been in use by them and their fans for a long time already perhaps explains why they didn't really check if anyone else was using it before they officially made it their name. But soul singer Anita White felt that they should have, because she was performing live and on record as Lady A for long before they formed in 2006. And when criticising their decision, she expressed anger that their, you know, apparent gesture of solidarity with Black Lives Matter had seen them take the name of a black artist, apparently without any thought.
Yes, because although I think nobody would disagree with the statement that Lady Antebellum / Lady A are a much, much, much bigger, more successful act, certainly more commercially successful than this singer, Anita White, who also performs as Lady A. She did say that Rolling Stone magazine, who had an early interview with Lady A, this whole section is going to be so confusing, isn't it? Lady A and Lady A. But Rolling Stone, who had an early interview with Lady A, the singer, before they did that interview, had found her on Spotify. So they were saying, well, if the Rolling Stone journalist can find me on Spotify, okay, maybe she doesn't have that many subscribers or followers or listens on Spotify, but she's on there. Why hadn't Lady A, the band, done a cursory search of Google or of Spotify to see whether or not anybody else was using it? So that's what Lady A, the singer, said almost as soon as Lady A, the band, had made their announcement. Lady A, the band, then responded to that response pretty damn quickly too. And they basically said, we didn't know about this. We didn't realise that there was another person using this name. We've got in touch and we're going to have a meeting with her. We're hopeful that we can just sort all of this out in a simple Zoom call.
Yes, and then they posted a screen grab. Both of them posted on social media a screen grab of them having this Zoom call. Everyone's smiling. Lady A, the singer, said that she was so glad to speak with these amazing young people, while the band said that they were all moving forward with positive solutions and common ground. And there was seemingly talk of both acts coexisting with the same name and just carrying on and having mostly separate careers, although there were also apparently discussions that they would do a collaboration together, billing it as Lady A featuring Lady A, and that would kind of be fun. And so it all seems like they'd come to some kind of amicable solution pretty quickly, which is a good thing, although that seems to have also soured quite quickly when Lady A, the singer, hired new lawyers who suggested that she should be getting some money for all of this.
Yeah, so although that Zoom call, I'm saying it's a Zoom call, I don't think I actually know they use Zoom. Other video conferencing platforms are available. But even though that call seemed to have gone very well, yeah, as soon as the lawyers got involved, things seemingly fell apart. Now, whether or not that's the fault of Lady A's lawyers or Lady A's lawyers, you can have your own opinion, because apparently Earlier this month, there was a report that Lady A, the band's lawyers, had put together a written agreement, which I think they thought summarised what had been previously discussed. But Lady A, the singer, seemingly didn't like what had been written down. So although she may have been supportive of what was discussed when they were all on the call, as soon as that was down in black and white, she wasn't impressed with what Lady A, the band's lawyers, had written. I assume that that's when she hired different legal representation herself. And now we've got two sets of lawyers, which is why we have litigation, because the new lawyers working for Lady A, the singer, basically went back to Lady A, the band's lawyers. I told you it would be hard to follow this, and said, we've got a different version of this agreement. And apparently there was a real change in tone. These new lawyers for Lady A, the singer, were talking about this being a dispute, where they'd not really used the word dispute before, and I think the word litigation started to be used. Yeah, so anyway, Lady A, the singer's lawyers went back to Lady A, the band, and said, here's an alternative agreement that we've written. And in that, they inserted what Lady A, the band, are calling an exorbitant monetary demand. We haven't had official confirmation in the legal filing on what that exorbitant monetary demand was, although it has been reported that basically Lady A, the singer's lawyers, were saying that as well as everything else that had been agreed, they were going to coexist, they were both going to use the name, they were going to do this collaborative track, that the band should pay the singer $10 million.
So it was in response to that that Lady A, the band, filed their lawsuit, in which they say they do not wish to prohibit White from performing under the name Lady A or otherwise identifying herself as a musical performer named Lady A, nor do they wish to seek any monetary damages whatsoever. Rather, they simply wish that the parties can continue to coexist without any money changing hands. So why then are Lady A, the band, not just launching legal action, but saying that really they are the owners of the name?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And there has been online quite a lot of backlash to the band since this lawsuit has been filed, because people are saying, which I guess is probably what Lady A, the singer's lawyers would say, is, well, hang on a second, Lady A, the singer, was using this name, performing under this name, before Lady A, the band, even existed. So if we apply a simple first-come, first-served rule, then surely Lady A, the singer, has the rights to this name. So why are Lady A, the band, coming forward and saying, OK, yes, we're happy for Anita White to continue using Lady A as a name, we're not trying to stop that, but we don't think that we should have to pay her any money to also use the name? Or even going further than that and saying, we're happy for her to use the name and we don't want her to pay us to use the name. And you could be like, well, hang on a second, she had it first. So therefore, the ball should be entirely in her court. So who are you to say we don't want Lady A, the singer, to pay us any money to use the name? Of course, she shouldn't have to pay you any money to use the name. And you might say, well, don't Lady A, the singer's lawyers, have a point that because she had the name first, if you want to carry on using the name, even though we understand you're not saying that Lady A, the singer, has to rebrand too, but if you want to carry on using that name, surely you should have to compensate Lady A, the singer, and pay us some money, hence the demand, which may or may not be 10 million. But although at first glance, it does sort of feel like this is Lady A, the big successful, commercially wealthy band, going to court and suing this grassroots singer who ethically should have the right to use this name because she got it first. That is certainly what it looks like at first glance. And I think a lot of people, probably having only read the headline of this story, that's what the backlashes are saying. But if you actually read the lawsuit, it makes a number of points. I mean, it talks about the fact that Lady A, the band, have been using the Lady A brand since, as I say, pretty much they formed in 2006. And okay, Lady A, the singer, may have been using it for 6, 7, 8 years before then. But nevertheless, it's not like Lady A are just now starting to use this name. They've used it on their website. They've used it in official communications. Journalists have used that name. So it's not new. They also point out that Spotify is able to cope with there being two Lady A's because there is a Lady A the band profile and a Lady A the singer profile on Spotify. So therefore, the industry can cope with two people using the brand. But most importantly, from a legal point of view, the reason why Lady A, the band, are sort of saying that they have the upper hand here is because they already own the trademark in the US to the brand Lady A, and they first registered that trademark all the way back in 2010 because, as we say, they have used it as an alternative name since pretty much the start. So they filed their original trademark application back in 2010. They got it. They then actually put a number of other registrations in because, obviously, when you register a trademark, you have to declare what sectors you want to have the exclusive rights to that name in. So I think the first one was music or live performance, and then they did another one to cover merchandise and another one to cover touring or whatever. So actually, over the last 10 years, they've registered the Lady A brand with the US trademark registry on a number of occasions. They've got those trademarks, and so their argument is, okay, Lady A the singer may have been using this name for longer, but when it comes to intellectual property rights, they are the trademark owners. And this Lady A the singer has never objected to those trademarks before. She didn't put in an objection when they were being registered. She's not sought to have them blocked. Now, she's a grassroots performer who possibly doesn't really understand how trademark law works or have the resources to do anything about that. But that is the legal argument. So that's why, although there is a backlash against the band, and I understand why there's a backlash against the band, in pure legal terms, they are kind of in the right, that they are the trademark owner, and therefore it is for them to say to Lady A the singer, we're happy for you to carry on using this name, rather than the other way around.
Yeah, so that's the key argument in their lawsuit. And one of the reasons they're going legal is to get court confirmation that they definitely own the name Lady A and have all the relevant trademarks in place. They point out, as you said, that White never contested any of their trademark registrations, but despite their, and they quote, open, obvious and widespread nationwide and international use of the Lady A mark. They also insist that they have only gone legal because of correspondence from White's lawyers suggesting that they were also considering litigation. So it's a case of who fired first, really.
Yeah, and I guess that's another important point, particularly in the context of the backlash that is now occurring over this litigation, is although there were all sorts of reasons why the band looked bad here, the two key things they're trying to say is, well, this is a trademark dispute and we're sorry, but we own the trademarks and that's just a fact. Plus, it's not big, bad, commercially successful band setting their super expensive lawyers on grassroots performer. I mean, that is what it is. But what they're saying is, actually, we're preempting that we suspect that given the new lawyers who've come on board for Lady A the singer, given the language they are using in their emails, that it looks like they are getting ready to go legal on this. And so therefore, as the trademark owners, we wanted to preempt that by going legal ourselves to, well, I guess now they've made this rebrand, they are planning on spending quite a lot of money on creating marketing materials and merchandise using the Lady A brand. So they want to be certain that before they start spending all of that money, that there aren't going to be some issues in the next few months or the next few years as a result of Lady A the singer going legal. So yeah, that's what they're saying is, we're only doing this because Lady A the singer's lawyers look like they're getting ready for litigation, maybe seeing that they could take a cut of any $10 million or whatever it was that the singer would get. And I suppose what in essence they are saying is, we're still really keen to do an amicable out-of-court settlement. We're still really keen to just get on with Lady A the singer. Maybe, I mean, whether or not that collaboration would still be possible, given that it's kind of got a bit nasty now, that might make that collaboration a bit interesting. But that's what they're basically saying is, we thought that we got a nice, fair, amicable agreement on the Zoom call or whatever it was, but now these lawyers on the other side have got involved. We haven't, so that is why we are going legal. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But I say, it's one of those things where I think the band's legal arguments are pretty strong, but when it comes to the court of public opinion, as they say, the PR challenges of this are going to be quite tricky.
And finally, the UK government made a number of announcements relating to the music industry getting back up and running after the COVID-19 shutdown in the last week, including that, as of last weekend, outdoor live music events are allowed to take place again in England. It also announced a VAT cut that will apply to gig tickets and announced a £1.57 billion support package for the creative industries.
Yeah, now that £1.57 billion support package was announced on a Sunday night for some reason, 10:30 p.m. on a Sunday night. That announcement was made. i.e. just before the last edition of Setlist was published. It had been recorded, it had been edited, we talked about COVID only a little bit at the start, but we talked about the Let the Music Play campaign and how the music industry and the wider creative industries were still making demands for sector-specific support because there are a whole lot of issues that are unique to the music industry and the theatre industry and the other cultural and creative industries. And the general consensus was that the government hadn't been acknowledging those specific challenges or providing the financial support to help music companies, theatre companies, cultural companies to get through the COVID pandemic. But yeah, before that edition of Setlist came out, this £1.57 billion package, I mean, that's a lot of money that is being invested specifically into the cultural sectors to help companies and individuals who have been negatively impacted by the COVID crisis to try and help them get through shutdown, which although it's starting to be relaxed, in many ways it's still in place. It's still impacting lots of people in the music and the theatre and the cultural industries. So specific funding to help those companies and people survive however long COVID shutdown continues to run for, to make up for some of the losses that have already been incurred. So a lot of money, a big investment by the UK government. So on one level, woo, well done. Although, of course, the devil is in the detail as to what exactly is going to happen to that £1.57 billion.
Yeah, that money is not just for the music industry or even just live entertainment. It's a pretty broad package for the creative and cultural industries, which includes museums, galleries, cinemas and the heritage industry, so historic places, things like that, and more, which means that while £1.57 billion seems like a very big number, there are a lot of organisations seeking their share of it. And it's worth noting, I think, that it costs quite a lot of money to run museums.
Yeah, the fact that museums and the heritage sector is in there as well, we have no clarity as yet as to how the money is going to be sliced up between the different creative and heritage sectors. But there are a lot of companies and organisations and people who are going to be going after that money. And of course, there are some institutions, and this is particularly true in the museum and the heritage space, there are plenty of institutions in that domain which are ultimately government-owned and owned by the state. So the government is entirely responsible ultimately for ensuring that they stay in business, even if usually they make most of their money by selling tickets or having cafes and restaurants or corporate events or whatever. So quite how much of that money will end up with the music industry is yet to be determined, which leads us to the common issue that the music industry has, which is that whenever government talks about arts and culture, you never quite know if music's being included in that. Obviously, it should be. It should be a given. But quite often when political people talk about culture, they will almost certainly be including classical music and opera and possibly things like folk music under that banner. But when it comes to other genres of music, it's never entirely clear whether the politicians, the ministers who are talking about culture have that in their mind. Now, when they announced the £1.57 billion, that statement explicitly said that live music venues would be part of this. And obviously the Music Venue Trust, which represents the grassroots music venues, had been calling for about £50 million of investment to keep those venues in business for the next few months while shutdown extends. So music definitely is part of this, and that's brilliant. But which elements of the music industry will be able to access this money? It wouldn't surprise me, and this isn't just for music, it's across the board, if an awful lot of this money didn't end up going to venues. So music venues, that's good. Theatres, art centres, etc. And I mean, those venues are really struggling. They need that money. But it's quite often with politicians, they're much more likely to give money to buildings they can point at than to people who make cultural stuff happen. And so it could be that a lot of this money ends up going to buildings. Now, those buildings might then spend some of that money by employing artists and performers and creators and crew and all of that people. So it might be the money gets shared out. But it's yet to be seen quite how much of that money goes to the wider music community and getting to the many, many grassroots, freelance, small businesses, and indeed the more usually commercial elements of the music industry who don't usually get any government funding, don't even usually ask for any government funding, but who in this moment in history need government funding. And will those people be getting it or not? That's not just a challenge for the music industry. I mean, it's been interesting, obviously, because we do stuff up at the Edinburgh Festival and through our This Week London and 3 Weeks Edinburgh websites, we pay a lot of attention to the comedy industry as well. And I think the comedy industry is even more concerned about this because while it's true, a big chunk of the music industry never really gets government support financially, at least some of it does. So you can try and build on the fact that some music things get government support, where the comedy industry hardly gets any government support usually. I'm not sure the Arts Council would even consider comedy to be in their remit at all. And yet the comedy industry has been hit in exactly the same way as the live music industry. And to the extent that the comedy industry traditionally hasn't had a trade body, they now have a trade body called the Live Comedy Association that has been set up specifically to do that. So yeah, the more commercial side of the music industry, the clubbing side of the music industry, and the comedy industry, all parts of live entertainment, who are concerned that they might not see their share of this money.
One other financial benefit for the live music industry announced last week was a cut in VAT. That's the UK sales tax, which will go from 20% to 5% for hospitality and leisure services. It wasn't initially clear if that applied to live music at all, but Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden confirmed later in the week that it will.
Yeah, and actually, interestingly, in that clarification on whether or not the VAT cut would go to venues, etc., because, I mean, when it was announced in Parliament, they tended to talk about bars and restaurants and then seemingly things like theme parks for some reason. But yeah, the clarification from the Culture Secretary, that was a nice, long, all-encompassing list, specifically including concerts and live performances. So I think that is one benefit that everybody involved, okay, again, only on the live side, so not on studios or recordings or anything like that, but when it comes to the different kinds of culture and creativity, it basically seems that what Dowden was saying was any ticketed events will benefit from this cut from 20% to 5%. And obviously, as a promoter of a show, you then have to make a decision that do you pocket that 15% difference to make up for all the losses you've incurred, or do you reduce ticket prices to try and get people who maybe still be a little bit concerned about going back to live entertainment through the doors, or a combination of the two. But crucially, unlike the 1.5 billion or whatever it is, where we're not quite sure who's really going to benefit from that, hopefully that VAT cut will apply across all of the cultural and creative industries where live performance is part of the business.
One problem with that, however, is that it's currently set to last for 6 months. And the problem there is obviously that it might be more than 6 months before live music is fully up and running again. Although, so long as tickets are on sale while the tax cut is in place, then they will benefit from it. I did see one live music company joke that they were about to put all of their shows until 2025 on sale so that they made sure they got a big benefit from it.
Yeah, the point there being that you charge the VAT at the point the ticket is sold, not the day the show happens. So yeah, although it may well be that there aren't that many, certainly indoor shows happening within the next 6 months, providing you're selling tickets to those shows, it doesn't actually matter if it's that. Aside suggested, if the show's not, providing you can persuade people to be buying tickets for shows in 2025, you could be selling tickets now and you would get the benefit of that break.
Yes, but while obviously people want to be selling tickets, what they really want to know is when shows are actually going to start happening again. And as said at the beginning, the government did announce last week that it is allowing outdoor shows to take place again. Obviously, there've already been announcements of drive-in shows where people would watch the performance from their car, but this would be, you know, people actually out in a field walking around, although with a reduced capacity from what you would normally expect for a show like that. But that is now allowed to happen. So maybe we'll see small festivals or just, you know, little outdoor gigs going ahead in parks and fields in the near future.
Although, once again, devil is in the detail. There was some guidance published alongside this announcement that outdoor live performances will be allowed again. This is only in England because it's up to the Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish governments as to what happens in those parts of the UK, but in England. But yeah, devil in the detail. There will still be some social distancing requirements which will impact on capacity. So the question is, how much does it impact on capacity and at what point do those events not become commercially viable? I mean, potentially there's the hope that if you're doing a show in a field, maybe you can take the next field along and just have more space. Whereas obviously in an indoor venue, there's always an unmovable fixed capacity. So who knows? But there will also be some other measures in place for these outdoor shows that could affect how feasible they are for people to put on. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see, do we now see a flurry of events? Either those events in August and September that hadn't actually fully said that they were going to cancel, will they now go ahead? Will we see some new events being announced? Or will it turn out that once you take all of the new restrictions into account, it's still actually quite hard to run commercially viable events, even in the open air?
So there has been some positive news for the live music industry over the last week, although obviously still concerns remain. One of the big concerns is that this is the government moving towards a point where it will say, right, everything's back to normal now, and start winding down its general COVID-19 support packages before the music and creative industries are actually back in operation. Plus, of course, there remain all the freelancers who've fallen through the gaps in those general schemes and still haven't received any support whatsoever. So it's some positive news in the last week and some indications of getting some way back to normal, but still a lot of uncertainty and concerns ahead too.
Yeah, and a number of music industry organisations saying, obviously, the 1.5 billion plus financial commitment is incredibly welcome. So we didn't completely expect that to happen, so that's good. The VAT cut is good. The fact that we are starting to get some sort of live formats back is good. But, yeah, devil in the detail, as I've said several times, and it may well be still that the support is not distributed across the board, and there will be certain categories of companies, certain categories of performers or people working in the music or the creative industries who end up not getting the support and end up going out of business or having to sort of change careers, etc. So some good stuff has been happening, but lots of challenges ahead, I guess, is the is the conclusion to that.
But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Do remember to subscribe, rate and review. And if you have any questions or comments on this episode of Setlist, email us at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.